Coming up today, how naked mole rats could help humans live for 500 years. We get to grips with Uber's worrying finances and our top cultural picks of 2016. You're listening to episode 299 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Williston.
Hello.
Liat Clark.
Hello.
Ruby Lott-Lavinia.
Hi.
And Amelia Heathman.
Hello.
Everyone, apart from Matt Burgess. 299, so we're nearly at 300. It's our last of the year.
We should do something for the 300th.
Yes.
Recommendation.
CES special.
This is what I'm asking for.
A seniors special.
CES special.
That makes more sense.
Vicky and Burgess on the strip.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
As we mentioned last week, Vicky and Matt Burgess are off to lovely Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show. So we'll either have our first podcast of 2017 from there or shortly after there.
Hopefully from there.
We'll see.
We will see.
Let's get straight to it. A thing you learned this week. Vicky, you can go first.
So I learned this week that cats can't taste sweet food. But dogs can taste salty, and it's based on their nutritional needs, and it protects them from toxins. So if in the wild, a cat wouldn't eat something that was sour or bitter, for example.
Okay, but dogs will eat anything.
Dogs will eat anything, even their own poo.
Yep, that's a fact.
Mine actually leads into this.
Go on, Leah.
This is more evidence that cats are better. Apparently, cat's memory is about 200 times better than a dog's. And I just think... yeah, dogs eat their own poo.
So they forget. They forget how bad it was.
Yeah, yeah. They need to. Necessity for that. Mm-hmm, apparently, a short-term memory for a dog is about 5 minutes, and cats can remember up to 16 hours.
Dogs rule.
Dogs are much better than cats. Sorry, Leah. Overruled.
I mean, the evidence disputes this.
Seemingly. Ruby, you haven't written down a fact on our notes. Did you learn anything this week?
No, I've learned nothing, as per most of my weeks.
Excellent.
It's a mystery to you all. So what I learned was that Hitchcock released Psycho in black and white because he was criticised for the shower scene being too graphic. So kind of one of the massive defining features of that film was because people were too scared of blood.
Hmm. Makes you think. Amelia, what did you learn?
There is a link between personality and smartphone choice. Psychologists at Lancaster University gave over 500 smartphone users several questionnaires about themselves and their attitudes towards their mobile phone. And it was found that Android users are found to be more honest and less likely to break the rules for personal gain compared to iPhone owners.
So how many have we got in the room? I'm iPhone.
Android.
iPhone.
Well, that's three.
There you go.
We're the reckless ones, guys.
Or to put it another way, psychologists at the University of Lancaster decided they quite wanted some coverage in the mainstream press. So they did a study about smartphone use.
And Android users are really cynical.
Yeah, that too. I learned this week. Amelia, a couple of weeks ago, did a Santa-based maths fact. I have another one via a PR company. Santa could potentially be about to receive enough beer to stack a football pitch almost six times. More than enough milk to fill an Olympic swimming pool. A mountain of mince pies exceeding the weight of 380 compact cars. And enough carrots to feed a reindeer for 668,400 years. That's according to a vending machine company.
The thing that I want to ask here is, I guess it depends on what people give Santa. So in my house, we do beer, mince pie, carrot. But some people will do... we give him a non-alcoholic beer. Okay, guys?
Yes.
We don't want him to get drunk. He is working.
We always give sherry,
yes,
carrot, mince pie,
classic,
and milk.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, sherry and milk?
Mm.
Well, yeah.
But it's that this PR company completely gave up on its quantities. More than enough milk to fill an Olympic swimming pool. Come on, guys. Please try harder. Our first story this week, Victoria Williston, is about Mark Zuckerberg and what he's been up to this year.
Yeah. So did any of you have New Year's resolutions this year?
Yes.
What was it?
No.
Oh.
No. It was to grow a beard and I succeeded and then... No, I didn't.
Yes, I had some. So one was to do one vegan day a week, which worked pretty well until I went travelling and I just ate all the food.
Even meat.
No meat, just a lot of dairy.
Eggs.
And then also to read before bed more often, which makes me sound very unbelievably square. But there's a lot of good literature that came out this year. So,
which we will discuss later. Amelia, did you have a New Year's resolution?
I think it was to be employed by the end of the year, which I managed to do, so.
Hooray! Liat?
No, I don't believe in them.
Well, someone However. Who does believe in them is Mark Zuckerberg. So whatever you did, you suck compared to Zuckerberg, because he's built servers and apps to create an AI butler like Jarvis in Iron Man.
This is such an elaborate project.
So he said it took him about 100 hours, which didn't actually seem that long. But I guess he has a full-time job running one of the biggest companies in the world. Mm. But anyway, so he used facial recognition with cameras. This was there was two really interesting things from the way he turned his house into this AI butler. He used facial recognition with cameras to know when people arrive. But what he was using it for is he would know when his daughter woke up, which is a little bit creepy, but he would know when his daughter woke up so that he could then, and Jarvis would automatically start reading a Mandarin lesson or playing music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that child's going to be so intelligent, it's unreal. But then he also had to reverse engineer toasters. So one of the things he wrote in his blog post is that he wanted breakfast. He wanted Jarvis to make breakfast for him. But the problem is you can't push a toaster down. It's something that I'd not considered. You can't push a toaster down unless it's turned on. So he'd have to reverse engineer it so that he could get it to turn on and push down at the same time.
Well, you just need a robot that could push down the toaster. His problem was that you can't turn a toaster on without the lever being pushed down.
With software.
So he had to go back to old-fashioned toasters.
So he got like a 1950s toaster and reverse engineered it. Sure. Then he connected a food dispenser to feed his dog Beast. So he did all this crazy stuff. He then built a Jarvis Messenger bot. So here is where the Facebook link comes in. He's pushing his team and his developers and his bots and everything. But he built a server so he could send requests to Jarvis through this Messenger bot, which would then control all these different things in his house. And one of the things he mentioned, which I hadn't really considered, is that in his office, for example, he would say to Jarvis, "I want the AC on." But how the preferred temperature that he likes it is different to his wife. So by then recognising his voice rather than Priscilla's voice, it could then turn it to, in theory, turn it to his temperature. And when she goes in, he goes, "I want the AC turned to my temperature," it could turn it down based on what they prefer. That's when it started getting a little bit more than just Amazon Echo and Google Home and more towards Iron Man Jarvis.
But back to the toast. If he was to say, "Put on some toast," would it come out a different level of toastedness to Priscilla's?
Oh, I don't know, but in theory he could do that.
Mm, yeah.
See, this is really exciting. I would love to have a smart home. I don't have the time to set it up, and I don't have the money to buy all of the different smart products, all the connected products. Obviously Zuckerberg does.
So if you're incredibly rich and incredibly intelligent and have seemingly unlimited resources, the home of the future is available to you right now.
I mean, he can pay for a full staff, so
yeah,
I don't think he has to put his toast down.
I mean, none of us had particularly good New Year's resolution. Ruby, yours were quite noble.
Mine was to get a new job.
Oh, well,
I got a new job.
Go, Vicky.
Congratulations.
And actually, I would just like to make a point that the last 3 years, 4 years, every time I've set a New Year's resolution, I've stuck to it because I'm an iPhone owner. And So I wanted to be on TV and I was on Countdown. I wanted to get a new job. I wanted to learn to knit. And this year, I want to learn to play golf.
Can we go back to Countdown?
What? Always.
What happened there? You were on a full episode.
It's a bit of a long story that I will cut down for you. I wanted to be on a TV show. I applied to everything. I applied to Countdown, Million Pound Drop, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Eggheads, got a team together, everything. Got accepted for Mastermind, answering Alan Partridge questions. Went through the first round. And then Countdown came back to me and said, "Oh, we want you to be on our show." So I went on Countdown. I lost. Oh, no, sad.
Wait, how far did you get?
Just the first level. Just the first go.
Oh, but you still did it.
I was still on there. And I was against an astrophysicist who absolutely smashed me on the numbers. Oh, so I was never going to win. But once you've been on a TV show, you sign a contract that says you can't be on another one for however many years. Oh. So I'm now coming up to the point where I can now go on Mastermind again. So my application's going in the new year.
Golf and Mastermind. A second story is about naked mole rats, Amelia Heathman.
Naked mole rats are really, really cool, and scientists think they can help slow human aging by studying them.
Sound a little bit more enthused. How cool? They're really, really cool. How cool are they?
I'm trying to stress how cool they are.
They're so cool, they don't even need to be cool.
Pretty much. So they've evolved to feel little to no pain. They can live up to 32 years, which is 16 times the common rat, which can live to just 2 years. They live underground, they're really clean, and they have no sweat glands, which I think is the best.
What a great animal.
pretty much.
But they're scientifically interesting, one, I guess, because they feel no pain, yeah, and two, because they have a biological defense against cancer.
Yeah, and so the cancer thing is really, really interesting. Biologists from the University of Rochester in New York discovered that the matrix that supports tissues of a naked mole rat is full of a substance called, I'm going to try and pronounce this word, hyaluronan.
Close enough.
Yes. This happens to prevent cancer from growing as well as acting as a lubricant. And the scientists found that if they prevented the mole rat tissues from generating this lubricant, they started to grow tumours. So they think that they can use this as a way to help develop cancer treatments for humans and help prevent humans ever growing cancer. And as well as that, they think that to do with this is also a way that why they help... to do with the fact that they don't feel any pain is a reason why they probably live so long. Because they can live in these hot conditions underground, and this allows them not feeling any pain allows them to maintain vital energy, which is why they can probably live so long.
So when the apocalypse strikes in 2017, we should all look to the mole rats.
Pretty much.
Yep.
But if you want to live like a sad life huddled underground.
Yes.
You know, covered in each other mole rats.
But they don't sweat, so it's fine. Yeah. It's absolutely fine.
They're just like squished against each other, silent in the dark.
But oddly, this brings us to Google.
Yeah. So Calico Labs, which is owned by Alphabee, which is Google's parent company, this was set up with the goal of finding out how to slow aging and extend human life. Bill Maris, who is the former head of Google Ventures until he stepped down earlier this year, he was the one who set it up, and he thinks that it should be possible for people to live for 500 years. I mean...
Should it be possible?
Well, this is what they're trying to find out, but I mean, does anyone really want to live that long?
I'm cripplingly afraid of death, so okay. that would work for me.
Yep.
I think my problem would be is that if I could stay in a certain age, in a certain physical state, I'd happily live for a long time, although I'd have to work all that time. But I think if you got to a stage where your body was failing, but your body would just carry on for another 400 years, I think I'd probably take a ticket out.
You need you and all your loved ones to be in optimal physical health. Otherwise, it's pointless.
And that's true, actually. If you're living for 500 years, but you're a test case and other people aren't, you're going to see loads of people die around you. Oh, my God, now I have a fear of death.
But you could keep naked mole rats and they would keep you company.
Yep. Okay. I think we've lost the point here slightly. So,
I will tell you what Calico is actually doing with naked mole rats. The scientists are trying to sequence the naked mole rat genome in order to understand the animal's genetics. And this should help researchers shed some light on why they appear to cheat the aging process. And hopefully they can use this to then work out how humans can do it. So then we can all live for 500 years.
And not sweat.
Exactly.
Yep. And do all the other great things that mole rats do. Our third story. We're done with mole rats, right?
Mole rats are done for now.
There was nothing else to say. Good. Our third story this week is on Uber, which you might think, oh, that's terribly boring, especially when I say it's about Uber's financial results.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
Uber.
Yeah, Uber. As a private company, Uber doesn't have to publish an awful lot of its financials, but every so often something leaks. And earlier today, we're recording this on a Tuesday, which is very early because we're all about to run away for Christmas. But according to a source speaking to Bloomberg, Uber lost significantly more than $2.2 billion in the first 9 months of 2016,
Oops.
Which is careless. Yes. According to a source close to the company, in the third quarter alone, Uber lost in excess of $800 million. And that doesn't include its now defunct business in China. It's an awful lot of money for a company that's worth $69 billion and one of the most talked about tech unicorns on the planet.
$2.2 billion. How do you manage to lose that? If you're not including the fact that it's not running in China anymore, like how does that happen?
Yes, so the argument that an awful lot of companies that are going through, as they call it, a period of fast growth will make, that revenue grows and you push into new markets, but that makes profitability more difficult because you have to speculate to accumulate, you have to spend to earn. So even though Uber's net revenue is growing, the amount of money that it makes off the amount of profit that it makes off that revenue is shrinking, seemingly, and its profitability is shrinking. And this isn't what's supposed to happen. As Uber gets a bigger footprint in more markets, it's meant to become more profitable because it's able to not get a monopoly necessarily, but it's able to operate at greater scale.
They're going to have to start paying their employees properly, aren't they?
Well, this is another problem, of course. So if in various countries, people are petitioning Uber to say that they should be treated as employees, they should have rights, they should have paid holidays, sick pay, stuff like this. And at the moment, Uber is able to get away with cheaper fares for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is its staff are arguably paid less than, when they're not staff. It's complicated. Yes, so Uber's hitting up against all of these big problems. And its finances in the United States, Uber lost $100 million in the second quarter of this year, and that figure in the US alone. And that figure's sent to increase in the third quarter. So, I mean, this is all according to sources. It's not directly from Uber itself. But they're worrying numbers for a company that's much hyped.
So presumably Uber hasn't commented on this or...
No.
No. And they would just argue that they're, you know, doing incredible things like bringing us self-driving taxis, blah, blah, blah.
They might argue that, yes. So an analyst writing for Naked Capitalism, it's a fascinating report as far as reports into business models go. They found that Uber passengers are only paying 41% of the actual cost of a trip, with all the rest of it funded by Uber's vast, vast, I don't know, what would you call it? Cave of venture capital money. So they have all of this money that they're able to subsidize trips with, which means that when you take an Uber, it's much cheaper. Their hope, the market will grow so big that they'll be able to make money on those trips. But the fundamental cost of a car, a driver, all the infrastructure that you need, and probably lots of lawyers, makes it difficult to make money if you're subsidizing that heavily.
And that's the reason why I use Uber, is because it's cheap. I think if they were to a point where they have to start raising their prices and it starts putting up against some of the other companies or even black cabs, I'd just choose whichever one is the cheapest. I know that sounds really lame, but that's the way that I work.
Yeah, that's absolutely how it works. It's kind of a false economy. I was talking to this with someone else in the office, and their point was that it's almost a mad sprint. Can they, before they run out of energy, before they run out of money, can they get to the finish line with this artificial boost of venture capital money? Can they reach profitability before they run out of cash?
That's insane. They're like subsidizing an entire business model, if that's true. Like, that's completely unsustainable. It's all going wrong. We're going to have to pay full price soon.
Yep.
But there's so many startups that run that way. You know, it's all about kind of ambitiously working off the, you know, seed funding you get, or like your stage one funding. You know, it's all to do with kind of how quickly you can like push your company forward on the little amount of money that you have and then fund again.
And in Uber's case, it's waited longer than most to go public. So the idea is that you can get your value to such a point where you have something to sell, you have a user base, you have something tangible, even if it's not physical. It's a tangible worth to someone that they're willing to snap you up, like Facebook buys WhatsApp or Instagram or something like that. Uber was this kind of much vaunted unicorn of the industry, and now it's starting to struggle a bit. And this week as well, not on financials, we saw something very tangible. The firm started testing its self-driving vehicles in its hometown of San Francisco, which everyone noticed pretty quickly because they started running red lights. Which,
yeah, this didn't go well.
The video of this is extraordinary, far as a car driving very slowly through some red lights is.
In a statement they came back, I'm not sure if it's directly from Uber or whether a report came out or something, but they were saying about how actually, oh no, it wasn't the car that ran the red light, it was a human behind the wheel in the car running the red light. And there's this really grey area about how, okay, well, was the human driving through the red light at the time, or was a self-driving car driving through the red light but the human was there and should have stopped it?
Yes, and this is all without gaining approval of the regulators in San Francisco. Uber says it doesn't need that approval. It's essentially ignoring the local regulators. The San Francisco regulators are going, well, this is a self-driving car on our roads, it needs to be approved, and you're operating it outside of the law.
It's actually California-wide. So they're actually, yep, like properly battling, you know, whoever the highest permit man is or woman in California.
Yes. And on day one, this was spotted on day one. Yeah. Numerous vehicles running red lights and other traffic violations. On December 19th, Uber admitted there was a, quote, problem with the way the vehicles crossed bike lanes.
Quite a problem. Mm. Cyclists, cars, quite a big problem.
Yes. Uber, to my mind, Uber's approach has always been to be quite bullish and ambitious, to put it diplomatically.
Like, death as a side effect.
No,
in
respect of, they can go into new markets and they can behave in a certain way. Because
behaving that way when it comes to this kind
of
thing.
They have
like
faith that the regulation
PR
will catch up,
yeah,
right? And in this instance, they might get caught out because it can go through courts for years and years, the different regulations around employment and are you a taxi, are you or not? It's quite dry. Hitting a cyclist, which they haven't done yet, but if there is a problem with the software, hitting a cyclist will be on the front page of every single paper in the world if they do it. And that's not going to be good news for them. So they might want to be a little less bullish on this one. That would be my tip to Uber. Now we're going to finish our podcasting for 2016 with a cultural roundup. We've mentioned that it wasn't a great year, but culturally, Ruby, and you've written about this on wired.co.uk, it's been pretty great.
Yeah, so whenever I come on the podcast, I like to squeeze in as many mentions of Beyoncé as possible. So whilst 2016 has been an unbelievably dreary and horrible year, I was trying not to swear there, it has been incredible for culture. And, you know, I guess struggle does tend to produce good art.
Deep.
Yeah. Yep. So I wrote up Wired's top 16 albums of 2016.
See what you've done there.
Yeah. Which, you know, if you haven't read yet, it is some fire analysis and
so you've sorted everyone's Christmas playlist.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And number one on that list, which deserves a shout out, is Lemonade by Beyoncé, which was a visual and, you know, musical phenomenon in so many ways. We live in a post-Lemonade world. I remember when I came back from a night out and it was quite early in the morning and I just heard on Twitter that Beyoncé had dropped a new album, and I just proceeded to stay up and watch the whole thing and, you know, download Tidal for the only reason anyone ever downloads Tidal, which is to watch either Lemonade or maybe like a Drake video.
The business model works in one instance. But what else made it onto your list?
So there's also... we've got The Life of Pablo, which kind of is quite controversial when I think you look at Kanye's former albums. I think people, they don't like to accept that Kanye is still creating good music. I think that's a very trendy thing to say, but I think actually there's a lot about surface in the album. It's very clever. There's a lot of references himself, which is something he loves doing. And whilst he's not maybe hitting the kind of heavy racial notes of his earlier albums in his verses, it's a really incredible album. There's also Ariana Grande, amazing. I love pop. She is great. Anti, which was massively by Rihanna, which was massively overlooked. I think maybe it's quite guitar-y for an era that is moving towards like trap and R&B. Obviously, it's a hip-hop R&B album, but it still had quite a lot of guitar influence. And OSC at the Table by Solange, which is a beautiful, funky, amazing album.
Much nodding from fellow podcast
Good, I'm glad to hear it.
Speakers? People. Podcast people. What were the criteria for appearing on the list? Because it's not just a random list of music that you like. We had criteria, right? Mm.
Yeah, so I think it was also artists that were innovating within their genre. So if you look at, for example, Childish Gambino's most recent album, Awaken My Love, you know, he's a rapper and he very much uses kind of punny verses in his previous two albums. And this album was a complete shift. It was very like funk soul, which I guess in some ways is very much a throwback in the way that it is also innovating. But there's lots of grime artists doing really interesting things as well with the genre, which has again kind of had a reemergence in the last, I guess since sort of 10 years ago. It was also any sort of sick hits.
Sick hits.
Sick hits was the
it's a very wired term.
The number one criteria. Do you have some sick hits?
Yep. So you can read all 16 mini reviews on wired.co.uk, and there's some little YouTube embeds so you can have a listen to some of the tracks if you've not heard of them, and then go to your favourite streaming service and spend all Christmas listening to them. Let's open this up. The culture was about more than music. It's about so many things. Who wants to pick out their cultural
Me.
Top picks? Vicky, go on.
So
and then we can disagree with you.
I think I want to talk about TV. I think BBC absolutely smashed it this year. I think they definitely put forward the case for the licence fee. Planet Earth 2 had me gripped, had me crying.
R.I.P. Turtles.
R.I.P. Turtles.
But it's all right, because they picked up all the turtles that they saw and put them back.
Yeah, but what about the ones that got squished under the cars? Sorry, spoiler. But still.
Yep, natural selection.
For a point for BBC, they did War and Peace earlier this year, which was incredible, and I think everyone will have forgotten about by the end of the year, but that was amazing. Visually, it was beautiful. Made me want to go to Russia.
Second series of The Missing. That needs to give a shout out. We had a huge debate about Baptiste and what we thought about him in the office.
We did.
Was there a debate? We loved him.
We loved him. Ruby didn't. Yeah. End of debate.
I like him. I've got some criticism.
But also, for people who aren't in the UK who don't have access to the BBC, I really like The Night Of this year. I thought it was quite a nice little standalone series. And Westworld.
I don't think we can talk about culture in 2016 without talking about Westworld.
But we also shouldn't talk about anything specific to do with Westworld.
No.
Because some people might not have seen it yet.
My point, I really did not like Westworld to start off with. I persevered with it. First five or six episodes, I thought it was dull. I had no interest in the dialogue between the hosts and the humans. Not interested at all. Episode 7 happens, and wham, I'm 100% fully invested in this. So if any of you are struggling like I was, at least get to episode 7 and then give it a go.
Leah, your list of 2016 cultural highlights seems to consist entirely of watching box sets of stuff that's been out for years.
Mine's really embarrassing because obviously I barely left the house because of baby, so she really held me back, and Netflix was able to come into its own. So there was a lot. I watched a lot of old stuff, old like House of Cards, a few months old, and 24, but also Stranger Things.
That's a staggering pick.
Stranger Things,
yep. Okay,
epic. Well, I really enjoyed that. Master of None, hilarious. But Westworld actually as well. Westworld was. I just can't imagine how you found it boring the first few episodes when they were just like murdering people willy-nilly. Heartless Vicky.
That's a lot of
the
TV
the layers did mount. But yeah, sadly I didn't get out of the house much. But
films
I wanted to say something about films actually for 2017, guys.
Go on.
Because I don't know why, but for some reason in the middle of the night I was watching lots of trailers for 2017 films, and I noticed a pattern of devastating but hopeful films. Some kind of devastating event, and then hope and beauty in the world is discovered again. And I feel like it's going to be the antidote to 2016.
You've cracked Hollywood's secret.
I have. There's a lot of like, my kid died, my wife died, but I'm helping Maisie Williams of Game of Thrones.
I mean, that was 2016's films as
no,
well.
That was 2017.
No, Batman 2016. I mean, Vicky, I see you put down The Revenant, which
I didn't leave the house.
Where a man loses everything to a bear and then finds it again.
See, yeah, but no.
Can I just highlight The Revenant and Hail Caesar?
Okay.
And Legend. All of them were so disappointing to me. Now, I know it sounds like I think everything's boring, but I really, The Revenant, I could see why it won all the awards that it did, because it visually, it's really, really good. I got bored with it, though. I think, and the same with Hail Caesar. I just didn't see the point of it. And I love Coen films. I absolutely love them. And I did not see the point of it. I got to the end of Hail Caesar and thought, what have I learned? This has been absolutely appalling.
I've
only watched about 5 minutes of Hail Caesar, but I have to say Revenant does not fit into the hopeful category because it's like, it's the bleak 2016 number is what it is. There's no, it's like great revenge. Maybe, absolutely fruitless.
Maybe it set the tone for the year because obviously it came out early in the year, came out for Oscar season, so maybe.
Is it Leo's fault then?
Let's blame everything on Leo.
Yes. But to a broader point, when we all sat down and thought, all right, what's happened in 2016? Everyone sort of can remember things that happened in the last 3 or 4 months. But you go back to January, like, duh, it becomes quite difficult to remember. Amelia, what did you pick out?
I loved Mr. Robot this year. Me and my sister became completely hooked on Rami Malek's beautiful face and him kind of trying to save the world, but in a really warped kind of way.
For many people, the only reason to get an Amazon Prime subscription.
That literally was our only reason. We watched Mr. Robot, and then we did enjoy The Man in the High Castle, but I have heard mixed reviews of the second season.
Transparent as well is good.
Yeah, haven't watched that one yet, but that's supposed to be really good. And then also, if we go into podcasts, because I'm a number one podcast fan, apart from the Wired UK podcast, of course,
which obviously
is number one.
And your own. Can you give your own a shout out?
Oh, it's a radio show, whatever. So it's a bit different. If you want to listen to Sister on Shoreditch Radio, you can do, and you can hear my dulcet tones talk about 90s music.
Nice.
Anyway, moving on. My favourite podcast this year was Reply All, which was recommended to me by Matt Burgess. And it's a show about the internet and basically the ridiculous things that happen. They did a show where they just opened the phone lines and for 48 hours and then had people ring them and talk to them, which was kind of fun and is also like a different show. And then they also did a one explaining Pizzagate. If you don't know what Pizzagate is, download this episode and listen to it. It's really interesting and just kind of shows, a bit of the mad, crazy world we're living in at the moment.
Because you came in after listening to that podcast and it really affected you. You talk about Pizzagate and you're going, oh my God, this is so shocking. I can't believe this happened.
I know. And every time I see Pizzagate now, I'm like jumping on the story and wanting to follow it. But the way it happens in this, so what they do in Reply All is they try and explain a concept on the internet to like their producer. So they talk about Pepe the Frog and all those kind of weird things, lots of memes. And they started talking about Pizzagate and they had kind of like stopped recording the episode. And then over the weekend, this massive thing blew up. So then they were like, well, 48 hours later, we're coming back to this story with this crazy thing happening. So it was really good. Listen to it.
That's a good podcast recommendation. I was thinking about this. Star Trek being dumped on Netflix for me was was a huge cultural event of 2016. So far as just putting on television and not really needing to pay attention to it, but it being there in the background constantly.
Favorite series?
Favorite series, Next Generation.
Sure. Right,
favorite episode, we won't go into it. football also. I know we're not all football fans here, but Leicester City winning the Premier League here in the UK. And England, even though I am an Englishman, losing to Iceland in Euro 2016. Wasn't necessarily a cultural highlight, but it was still fairly amusing. It seems strange to say it's my cultural highlight, but 2016 has seen an awful lot of really amazing people die. And that isn't a good thing. But when someone that you really dearly love dies, it's a good chance to look back on their life, remember them, celebrate them, which in terms of culture means that you've got loads of great films and music to suddenly dive into and reminisce about and talk about. So we've got David Bowie, Alan Rickman, Prince, Gene Wilder, Leonard Cohen, just to name a few.
And
it's
the thing with
pretty
that
amazing
is when these stars die that certainly some of us grew up with, it introduces that to a new generation. To try and get something positive out of something so negative, it means that new generations, the next generations and their children will then watch all these sorts of these films and listen to their music, and it'll suddenly span these wider generations, which I think is a really good thing that we can take from it.
I have actually, every time I'm home alone, been playing David Bowie to my one-year-old daughter on a loop.
It's so a good education.
It's already happening.
And cheerier than Leonard Cohen. Definitely
not
a better choice.
She's not ready.
And not quite, probably more appropriate than Prince in some
well,
albums.
I don't know,
some albums.
Yeah.
I've found that this week with is it Zsa Gabor dying?
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about her, but all these incredible quotes that she keeps saying are coming out at the moment, and that's really amazing. She was 99, I think, when she died. So you know, fair play. She'd get to 500, but she did pretty well. all the amazing stuff that she said keeps coming out, and I'm like, oh, it's such a shame that I didn't discover her beforehand. But it's a way of definitely like. Showcasing her to a new generation and things like that.
And the more people that can watch Gene Wilder's Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory, the better, because it's probably the most magical film from my childhood.
And so. It means that you don't watch the Johnny Depp version, which is
tragic.
Awful.
Yeah, just quite awful. Did anyone else have... Is there anything we haven't mentioned? We've written down a lot of notes, I realise.
I'd quite like to give a shout out to some books that I read this year.
Books?
Books, I know.
Books.
I've heard of them. Some of them, I have them actually in paperback. They're not even on a Kindle. They're not on an app. I've gone proper retro with my Filofax.
Nice.
So I did some quotes from it earlier in the year, but Nomad, Alan Partridge's book, Steve Coogan's book. I want to give a shout out to that.
Highbrow.
The other end of the scale was Adam Rutherford's A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived.
Okay.
I really, really enjoyed this, actually. The first chapter is called Horny and Mobile, so I think it sets it up quite well. It talks about the end of race, it talks about why it's important not to be inbred, and it just follows the whole of our evolution, which was really interesting. And then Laurie Winkless's Science in the City. Now, I loved this. We actually did a story about Crossrail. She went to loads of different cities around the world and looked at their infrastructure and their transport and how they build them. Now, I know that sounds really boring, unless you're really into tunnels like I am, and now Elon Musk, but I think it's definitely worth checking out. And there's videos that she's done and interviews, and I think that was a really good highlight of mine.
So it's a book about tunnels that isn't boring. Sorry.
Sure. Yeah. Promise.
Is it about tunnels or is it about how it makes people interact? No.
Well, yeah, it does. But there's tunnels in it,
just
and that
tunnel,
was my highlight.
Boring, as in.
Any more for any more.
My favorite book didn't come out this year, but I want to give it a shout out because it changed my life. A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihari. I apologize if I pronounced that wrong. This was an incredible book. It's absolutely huge. I was reading it on Kindle, so I don't think I realised how big it was until a friend told me that it was probably the width of my head. But it was an incredible read. I cried so much and was just really beautiful. So if you're looking for a really meaty read to get your teeth into, this is the book you need.
I really want to read that. It's going to be amazing. So this year it was a Booker nomination called A Hot Milk by Deborah Levy, which is unbelievable. It's really witty and funny and intelligent, and also kind of very touching depiction of like a mother-daughter relationship, but not in like a awful Booker way, kind of like a very clever piece of literature from this year.
Yes, Vicky.
I would just like to say one more thing, that this is Ruby Lotlavinia's last podcast with wired.co.uk.
RIP Ruby Lotlavinia.
She's leaving us at the end of, is it end of next week? Technically, well, so yeah, it's end of this week. Yeah. So thank you very much, Ruby.
Thanks to my fans. Keep in touch. I'll miss you.
Yep, yep. Well, so we'll end the podcast on that emotional note.
Totally.
It would have been nice to have Matt Burgess here as well, so we could have had the whole gang. But we did want to get everyone on for the last podcast of the year and the last podcast of the 200s. I could do some maths and work out how long we've been doing podcasts if we've been doing 300 of them. 52 weeks a year.
You've set yourself up for a fall here.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's 6 years, but we don't do them every week. So, yeah, we'd need a scientist or something. So that's us for 2016. That's Ruby forever.
Bye.
And we will see you renewed and afresh in 2017. Have a wonderful holiday break. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.